Welcome to the Wabash Center webinars. I am Nancy Lynn Westfield, Director of the Wabash Center. My studio team today is Carly Hollinsby. Carly is our tech director and she's monitoring our chat function. We're also joined by Paul Myrie, who is the sound engineer. Paul will be monitoring the question and answer function for the webinar. So near the end, about 15 or 20 minutes before the end of this hour, we will be taking some of your questions. So throughout the hour, feel free to use the question and answer time. Friends, this is our inaugural webinar for the Wabash Center webinars. And initially thought we would have 50 participants. And those 50 slots were filled up in 20 minutes. Now I'm sure it has a lot to do with the experts that we have on our panel today. So Carly quickly went to 500 participants. So welcome, people will be joining and coming in and out, but for this inaugural webinar, we are very pleased to start in this very robust way. We are gathering to discuss what it means to muster spirituality and imagination in this moment of pandemic, in this moment of upheaval and uncertainty. As faculty, administrators, and students living through and responding to the pandemic, we're in territory that we've never been in before. We are teachers and learners who are, if we are truthful, afraid. We are simply people who are afraid. The effects of COVID-19 in our communities means that most of us in less than 72 hours notice went from face-to-face classrooms to online classrooms, that many of our own faculty and students are aged persons, that many of us have underlying health conditions, that we are now homeschooling our children and perhaps other people's children, that we are separated from our elders in nursing homes and in hospitals. Many of our friends, our spouses, our partners are unemployed. Those schools who were already financially fragile in this time, this will push them into financial exigency. It is a time, brothers and sisters, of chaos. Compounding this problem is that we know that we live in a society that does not help us deal with uncertainty. We live in a culture, a larger culture, that does not acknowledge loss or grief or death. We also know that those among us who are marginalized in our society already are pressed, and this moment in history presses us even farther. For those who are living in impoverished conditions where they don't have the basic necessities, that just exacerbates the poverty that they are dealing with. We gather this afternoon to talk about this politic of suffering, to talk about the leadership roles, the role models that we can be as leaders. This important conversation needs to be happening right now because we are charged by our families, our schools, our students, our administration to keep it together. But the question becomes, how do we keep it together? In this moment of fear, we must resist being minds or bodies or spirits. We must resist that bifurcation. Suppose we sat together, and this is why we're here together, to talk about what does it mean to have a soul pedagogy, a pedagogy that calls us into wholeness, into our own humanness, not in a way that we're just minds or just bodies or just spirits. That we are people who are called to muster spirituality and imagination so that we can move forward. It is my pleasure to introduce our panelists this afternoon for this inaugural event. We are joined by Dr. Amy Oden, visiting professor of early church history at St. Paul School of Theology. Welcome, Amy.
It's great to be here, thanks.
And also Dr. Willie Jennings, Associate Professor of Systematic Theology and Africana Studies at Yale University. Welcome, Willie. Take your mute off, Willie.
Yes, I am so glad to be
here.
There
we go.
So sorry.
Understand, tech ain't easy. So Willie, let's start with you. In this moment where teachers are unfocused and students are scattered, and understandably so, what does it mean to have a healthy attention in this moment? What will it take for us to summon courage? How do we spend less time and pay less attention to the crisis, to the terror, to the fear, and more time to the souls of the people?
Well, thank you, Director Westfield, for that wonderful question, and thank you for inviting me to this inaugural webinar. I am so thrilled to be doing anything as a part of the Wabash Nation and the Wabash family, and to be a part of this very timely conversation. I'm so glad you're asking me about attentiveness and cultivating attention in this crucial moment, because it seems to me now we need a new focus on really maybe a new kind of attentiveness, one that is rooted in the work of the spiritual disciplines. Students and faculty, as you've already said in your opening comments, are bringing so much now to the teaching event, the teaching and the learning event. Full lives are now in front of these screens like never before. So we have the content that's been there that we're trying to teach, that students are trying to learn. But we also now have a world of emotions that we're trying to negotiate at the same time. And to me, as I'm talking to colleagues around the country, one of the mistakes that we can make at this moment is to imagine that we can sequester the emotions, the fear, the anxiety, the anger that is flowing through all of us at some level from the thinking we are engaging in with our students and as colleagues. I think right now we have to think about how we might reshape the time we have together in the digital classroom. How might we be together in this time and space that holds together what we are feeling and what we are thinking? And we've not been good at this in the way in which we've cultivated attention. In my forthcoming book, I spent some time talking about the problem of attention in the Western Academy. But I think there are two things I would like us to consider and I want to put on the table for our conversation. The first thing that I want us to consider is how we are narrating implicitly, and sometimes explicitly, our struggle against death and especially the fear of death. This is a crucial question now. Many of our students, as you mentioned, are coming out of and yet are part of contexts where the struggle, this struggle against death and the fear of death mark their daily life. But it's also the case, as you and I know, that for so many of us who are in the focus of this virus, potential carriers of it, those of us who are 50 and over, are thinking more about the menacing reality of death as well. And whether we want to or not, no matter what we are teaching, no matter what students are learning with us and from us, we are all narrating in some way this struggle. And it would be very good, I think very important for us to examine with our students and our colleagues how we are going about embodying that narration of the struggle. The second thing that I think is important to consider is how we might turn to the poetic at this moment. I think no matter what you teach, you need, you know, or whatever courses you're doing, it's time to think with poetry. It's time to press more deeply into poetry, because poetry, like prayer, maybe even with prayer, I would like to say, helps us live now in both the silence and the word, the silence of the inexplicable, the silence of holding together what does not make sense with what must be said in word, what must be felt through words. And so here are a couple of things I would like us to consider as we think about how we do our pedagogical work in this really crucial moment.
So about 20 minutes before we went live, I got a call from a dear friend who told me she was diagnosed with COVID yesterday. Mm. And it was startling to me, as it will be startling to so many of us when we get that news. The word, and I'm thinking about what you're talking about in terms of narrating the struggle. The word that she said to me was, "I just want you to know." Right. So we hear that from people as they're making this march into this unknown disease because the doctors are so debilitated in this moment. So someone saying the words, "I just want you to know," certainly challenges our pedagogical or informs our pedagogical understanding of what knowing is. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Just to listen to her and hear her say she has a diagnosis. So on one hand, I'm reminded of basic pastoral understanding. On the other hand, it also feels deeper than that, that she wants to be known, right? She wants to be known to me. As a person who now has an extra burden in her life. Yes. So I was at one hand honored that she called me and told me. On the other hand, I began to do what my grandmother and mother taught me to do, and that was recite scripture. So that's your poetic piece. And mm-hmm. I began to rock and sing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So help us get a little bit inside the narration part that you're talking about, to narrate the struggle for our students with our students. Help us know more what you're talking about.
Well, there's two angles that we want to consider here. The one, obviously, for those who are Christian, is how we tap into the way in which the multiple stories and traditions of the church think about the struggle against the fear of death. Mm-hmm. And recognize that's a real struggle, that death is not simply when you die. Death is already reaching toward us with despair, already reaching toward us with trying to drain our hope. And so how does one incorporate that reality into the teaching, into the learning, into the very environment with students, the digital environment, so that that palpable sense of the struggle, what we do is we make clear to ourselves and to students that we sense it, we sense the struggle even now, and we will not sequester ourselves from that struggle. And one of the worries I have in talking to many colleagues across the country is that I am thankful that for so many institutions, we have so many people who are all pulling in the same direction, not only faculty, but staff, people who deal with the everyday lives of students. But it would be dangerous to separate or have a division of labor where faculty just work with their content and their ideas. And then they leave the deans, academic deans, chaplains, CPE people, others to deal with the emotions. That kind of separation, we understand that everybody needs to pull together and do their roles, but that kind of separation right now can be incredibly dangerous and undermine exactly the kind of call I take it you heard in your dear friend's comments to you.
Absolutely, absolutely. She's been a professor along with me for many years. So you're talking about the soulful response to the classroom, the soulful response to the situation, the mm-hmm. soulful response to friends is not to trifurcate ourselves, but to be in the moment. So Amy, I want to bring you into this conversation. I don't want to go too long without having your voice in this conversation. So either start with a comment on what Willie's talking about in terms of this death dealing situation. And let's start from the basics too with your response. Why does spirituality matter for teachers at this time?
I think let's begin with attention and the ways this crisis, not only the specter of death and the ways we haven't been attentive, right, to loss and death in our culture and even in our religious cultures. But it's in our spiritual lives that we can find and hold the kind of inner freedom we need right now to exercise our imaginations, mm-hmm. right? So let me just say a word about that. That in our embodied practices, in our spirituality, in multiple traditions, that's the place we return to ourselves. We return to that center, to that grounding in divine presence, out of which then we can find enough freedom to exercise agency, Right. So as long as we are simply in a reactive mode, and most of us have been in a reactive mode, I would say, for several years now. So that's going to be our default, is kind of reactivity to the latest COVID numbers, to the latest demands from our institutions, right? But as long as we're in reactive mode, we're going to feel powerless. We're not going to tap into that inner freedom that then allows us to exercise our agency, to imagine what's possible, to have eyes to see how we are connected to one another, to our colleagues, to our communities. So I resonate so much, Willie, with what you're saying, and you too, Lynn, about really focusing now on an opportunity to come into the classroom, the digital classroom, as a whole person. And so in that way, to be able to model for our students what it's like to have enough freedom, right? To not just be kind of jerked around by the latest headline, but to be rooted in ourselves in such a way that we can be present to ourselves and to our students, and thereby exercise the kinds of imaginations that we are called upon, I think, in this moment. Mm-hmm. I think for many of us in many of our institutions, we haven't shown up as whole people. We may have even been punished for showing up as whole people. We certainly, in much of our own training, or maybe even our graduate school programs, were very much deformed or unformed in our own spiritual practices. But they are ready, and I think right available. So I encourage folks, I mean, if you're feeling frazzled and super disconnected, to just pause for a minute and recall that fire that got lit in you, that sent you to graduate school, that made you apply for jobs, that made you slog through your dissertation, right? There's kind of go back to your origin story, and you will find there something true about who you are and the call on your life. And sometimes just reconnecting to that can help us return to that center, to that grounding, rather than being in kind of a reactive mode to our to-do list.
So it reminds me of Toni Morrison in the novel Home. One of the characters says, in essence, find the free person that is inside of you and set her free to do good work in the world. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what I hear you both talking about, that there is a free person, an imagination inside of you, a freedom inside of you, that if we stay tight and reactionary, right, if we stay sequestered, right, to use Willie's word about the sequestered emotion, then we won't be good leaders. We won't create spaces in our classrooms for students to be empowered in this moment. But if we find and connect again with the free person inside of ourselves, and believe that she is in there, right, believe that she is there, that this is a moment that could happen.
Mm-hmm. I think that is so on point, Lynn. One of the things I want to encourage faculty not to be afraid of is being lost in emotivism, of losing control of the classroom in this moment. You know, we have to have a different strategy. The point is not to try to manage emotions, manage this moment, but to think all the way through it, to enter fully into it. And those of us who are inside spiritual disciplines that invite us to do that is to move deep into it, bringing our content and moving with our content and our students inside this very difficult moment. Now, for so many people, to even imagine that, as Amy said earlier, I mean, their doctoral programs told them that you never imagine how to move deeply inside the emotional space as you work your content, as you do your discipline. But we know that for those of us inside, and it's not just within the Christian tradition, with so many traditions, religious traditions, moving inside the emotional terrain, the psychic terrain, and moving inside, you know, this very rigorous thought are two sides of the same coin. And we have to embrace that at this moment, because I think our students, you know, if we don't, we will lose sight of all that our students are trying to hold together as they're looking at us on these screens.
So many of us gave up our spiritual traditions and poo-pooed and thought them inferior when we became PhDs, when we became scholars, when we moved into the life of the mind. We separated ourselves, almost like giving up our cow for beans, right? We separated ourselves from our own deep wells and the wells of the ancestors and the wells of the wisdom keepers, and instead became, you know, talking heads. So to go back to what we used to know in this time of crisis is a large leap, but it seems like I hear you both saying it is a critical leap at this moment.
Yeah. And we're not the only ones saying it or the first one saying it, right? Mm-hmm. There's so much going on around epistemology and knowing, and the folks that are participating today have already thought a lot about this, right? About what not only multiple ways of knowing, but the way we've kind of privileged the cognitive in a lot of Western academic culture. So in some ways, what a gift to have a moment when, and I want to be really careful here, I'm not saying COVID-19 is a gift, but we can exercise, I think, some moral agency, some freedom in this moment, and that can be a gift to begin to expand our pedagogies beyond the discourses, right, Willie? I think poetics is or other art forms, music, are other mm-hmm. discourses mm-hmm. that lead to other ways of knowing.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We are in a moment when we need also practical suggestions. When we start, what would happen in a classroom for both Willie and Amy if we started each classroom that's online asking people how they are, and that took up all of our time? One of the reasons why people are afraid for people to be emotional or to ask those soulful questions is that we feel like we only have these moments in time and we have to get through all the stuff and we're all busy and you know, all that kind of stuff. What is the harm if we spent our time in a classroom setting just telling people how they are?
Well, you know the immediate response, and Amy knows this very well, the fear that a student will say, I'm not paying for this. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm paying for you to make sure I know, you know, Old Testament thought or New Bible thought. I'm paying for you to teach me Greek.
That's the consumer mentality.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And we understand that. But this is a moment of risk. Mm-hmm. It's a moment of beautiful risk where faculty and students have to draw on the full power of their imaginations of how to teach inside the struggle, how to teach inside the pain, how to teach inside the fear, and how to learn inside it all as well. I mean, it's so important because, you know, one of the things we don't want is for students to imagine that learning requires, again, a sequestered mind. It does require attention, but it doesn't require a mind that is divorced from what it feels, divorced from, you know, all the emotions that are flowing. So those things have to be held together. But it does require, I think, as Amy was saying earlier, people to take a hold of their imaginative capacities and to push themselves inside those capacities in new ways.
And I do think, go ahead, Lynn.
No, go ahead, Amy.
Just practically, I think to be transparent about that struggle with our students. So for example, to say to my class, I'm concerned about covering everything this semester. I'm not gonna be able to. And that means I have to lower my expectations of myself as an educator. And I'm not gonna feel successful in the way I wanna feel successful. We're still gonna cover material in this class, but I want you to know I'm making a decision today that we're gonna take a big chunk of time at the beginning of class to do a check-in. And I've made that decision out of these pedagogical values, right? And And that models for them also the same choices they are making in their lives in the communities they lead, right? To not just go on as business as usual thinking we're going to get all the same things done. Learning is going to occur in this class, and I want students to know I didn't just throw the syllabus out the window. Mm-hmm. However, part of my job is to, in a sense, be sure we're all holding hands as we cross the street. And that means taking some time.
Yeah, I think that's so, I think that is so on point, Amy. There is a need at this moment to not simply rethink the syllabus, but rethink the very content that's on that syllabus and how we will work inside the spaces that are now thrust upon us because of this crisis. You know, if I'm going to have students for 50 minutes in this digital classroom, and I know that I'm really only going to get about 31 of those minutes in terms of their full attention, because their minds are going to be going here and there and everywhere while I have them, how should I think about the 50 minutes, knowing that it's not going to be 50 minutes because it's not going to be business as usual? And so rather than saying, okay, I'm going to try to cram everything in my 50 minutes, I'm going to say, I really think I only have about 24 minutes of their full attention. And then part of the time they're going to be thinking about grandmother, part of the time they're going to be thinking about their sister, part of the time they're going to be thinking about their money, part of the time they're going to be thinking about their future. So let me not try to force feed through the 50 minutes. Let me take those other minutes that are really now open space. That even though I'm talking, they're really silent spaces because students aren't listening. They're worried. Let me see if I can think inside that. And say, okay, look, I've been talking for 10 minutes and we've been talking for 10 minutes. Let's stop. I mentioned poetry earlier. Let me read a line of poetry to you. And you just sit with me for a minute. Let's sing a line of a hymn. Let's just sit with this. Because I know you gave me 10 minutes, but you're not going to give me minute 11 to minute 13. I can see.
Don't have it to give, right? Don't have it to give.
Right. So in minute 11 to 13, I'm going to read these two lines to you. And then we're just going to sit for a moment. I'm going to utter a little bit of a prayer and we're going to sit for a moment. Now, we're still going to move forward, but I'm modeling something else there. I'm modeling something really important. And in fact, all I'm doing there is performing a kind of spiritual discipline. You know, a kind of moment of meditation to hear what God is saying in the silence.
So the scary part is teacher then stops being manager. Teacher stops being police officer. Teacher stops being sage on the stage. And teacher becomes guide and person who sits with, right? That's a big move for so many people. Teacher becomes lover of our souls, right? Teacher becomes comforter, right? Teacher becomes person who is nimble enough not to lower expectations, but to shift expectations because the time is real, the circumstance is real. For so many of us, that's a very different metaphor for teaching and who we are in the teacher-student relationship.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. I like to think about this like jazz improvisation. When you're playing a song, the silence is just as much as the note. So knowing how to work with the silence, knowing how to stop and listen to the drummer, knowing how to pull your instrument back so the bass player can push her instrument forward, getting a better sense of the rhythm of it all, I think is going to be crucial in this moment as we're sitting with students.
And I don't want folks to hear from us in this conversation, okay, now, in addition to everything else, you have to become this other person who's, you know, spiritually wise and can, you know, right, in the classroom, but rather
the guru is born in the classroom.
Yeah, right, that's right. You could hear this as, mm-hmm. as a lot of expectation, but rather in many ways, just to get more simple.
Yeah,
that is
absolutely.
To become more connected to your own authentic gifts, the things that brought you into the classroom, right? You already have that. You don't need to add a bunch of new stuff on, but to then teach out of that place and yeah. give yourself maybe more freedom and more grace in a lot of ways to, you know, to experiment with that and teach out of that place.
Yeah. So what about our own emotions in the classroom? I hear us saying, be with students in their emotions in the classroom. What of the emotions we bring into the classroom, or what of the masks we try to wear in the classroom? And if those get eroded in these moments?
Yeah, yeah. That's the difficulty, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. It is a matter of wanting to feel as though you are
in control and right, charge.
And managing your classroom like you're supposed to.
That's right.
And there's something right about that. We're not trying to take that away from a faculty person. I think what I'm trying to suggest especially is that maybe a different strategy to enter in this moment is that you are leading people in the work of being themselves in a time of crisis. And that's, you know, in terms of pastoral ministry, that's the heart of it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not losing themselves mm-hmm. in the face of disaster, in the face of pain and suffering and fear.
And if you reveal to your students that you're a broken person, they already knew that. If you reveal to your students that you don't have it all quite together, they already knew that. If you reveal to your students that you are struggling like they are struggling, if you weren't struggling, you would be suspect to them in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Right. In that sense, I think this is a time of discovery, right? Pedagogically, but also our own kind of teaching identities. And in some ways it reveals to us the muscles, the teaching muscles we may not have developed up till now because we've sort of done the sequestering. Mm-hmm. And so this is an invitation to try out those muscles and we may discover some uncomfortable feelings or false starts in the classroom. But again, if we ever had a moment where we've got a spacious, wide kind of pass to do some trial and error, I think this is it. And to have a more integrative classroom. For me, what I notice is if there are scary feelings or I start to get really nervous, I can tell my voice is shaking, I'm not sure how much more time to spend on this in class, that kind of thing. You know, Willie, you suggested, you know, listening to a line of a poem or singing a line of a hymn. I will often just invite folks to pause and breathe and have a few seconds of silence mm-hmm. and let this all just kind of settle. And that's actually a lot easier to do with a group than by ourselves. And so mm-hmm. I don't hesitate to pause during class, but that's a practice I've cultivated with classes before this time, right? So they're used to seeing me do that.
Yeah,
for those of you, you know, if you haven't cultivated practices like that in the classroom, you know, then do some experimenting now.
Yeah. I love the way you put that, Amy. It's an unused muscle. And I think that is so important. And I do think we have to walk away from the deep fear of failure and the idol of success.
This is not
the stuff we need to be thinking about right now. The risk that's required means that we just have to let the problem about failure and or success and how well it went today, you know, let that go. I had at a institution I used to teach at, there was a coach of a basketball team who used to, when the players would come down and they would mess up a play and they would be looking at each other and saying, oh, you messed up the play. The coach would say, next play, just come, keep on going, next play. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to have that attitude, next play, don't worry about it. What we're doing is we're stepping into a space that in some ways, theologically speaking, God is calling us to, and it is the space of vulnerability, mm-hmm. right?
So, and the space of vulnerability is a space of maturity, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to take your eye off of yourself and put it on the game, on the ball, on the students, mm-hmm. on the transcendent is an act of maturity, not immaturity, that ultimately shows your strength, not your weakness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But knowing when to take the risks and taking them is an act of ability and capability, not inability.
And but it's very, I'm sorry, Lynn.
I was just going to say that's difficult for people to get that kind of, paradox.
Yeah.
Because it's very empowering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Paul, are there any questions from our participants?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Very good. Thank you. Yeah. The chat stream is a rich resource of comments and ideas and questions, and we won't be able to cover them all in the amount of time that we have here today, but hopefully we'll be able to move back to it in the future in some different ways. But there are several here that I wanted to bring up. One is this whole question of the power of poetry and art and literature to communicate the unutterable, to speak into the space in which we find ourselves. People are wondering about what art, what literature, what poetry do you find helpful in this moment?
Oh, I can speak to that. There are so many wonderful poets out there. But what I would recommend to everybody is to find your own, because my recommendations, though I can make many, you want to find your own. One, I can just name one person right now who's been very helpful to me is the poet laureate of the U.S. right now, Tracy K. Smith, her work. I have been enjoying her wonderful collection, The Body's Question. But I write my own poetry as well for myself. But I do think what you want to do is to find with your students, and one possibility would be to say to your students what poets are speaking to you at this moment, or what portions of scripture or what portions of any text are speaking poetically to you at this moment. And remember, always, this is what's one of the most important things that anybody who works in poetry would tell you. This is not about the expert. This is not about the specialist. This is not about people who say they really understand the depths of poetry. Poetry has to be approached by those who want to hear before those who want to know. To hear is to begin to know. So I would start with Tracy Smith. I do have a poem I'd love to read to you if I hear later on, but let's stick with the questions.
I think that the unutterable, the search for the unutterable is a fascinating question in and of itself. So I very much appreciate the question. I would also encourage that the notion of poetics is not just limited to poetry,
yes,
right? So there can be film clips, there can be photography, there could be, there's all kinds of use of image and story and art in general. So just don't limit yourself to a poem or a poet. Beyond that, I agree with Willie. You have to find kind of your own groove and where you're moving toward in the topic and the content that you're teaching and in the context that you find yourself. And of course, there are favorite poets like Rita Dove or there's just so many, it's hard to even list the ones that I very much appreciate.
I'll be glad to send a list to you, Paul, of the my 20 favorite.
We can put them on the Wabash Center website.
That sounds great.
Willie's favorite poets.
I love the idea of it. All right. There are also a host of questions in our question boxes in it for those listening in and wanting to ask questions. I encourage you to both post them there or send them to me at my email address at Wabash, and that's myhrep@wabash.edu. And hopefully we'll be able to address some of those questions in the future. Well, here's another question for the group to consider. This is from Chris Holmes. How much of these changes to pedagogy do you think will only last for the current crisis? And how might they last longer than the moment In other words, how might this temporal crisis reshape pedagogy for the long term?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think all three of us need to speak to this. If I could go first, I don't think we'll return to normal. I think this is a paradigm shifting moment. And I think the longer the moment lasts, of course, the more intense the shift will be and the deeper the shift will be before we come out of it. I think online teaching, if for no other reason than economic reasons, will stay more entrenched in our pedagogies and our curriculum than ever before, especially for residential colleges and universities that found themselves unequipped and unprepared. We know from the scientists that this is a first wave of a kind of virus, a kind of pandemic like this, that part of global warming is the increase of the number of pandemics that we will survive in our own lifetime. So I think the things that we begin to shift and do differently in classrooms and specifically in pedagogy in general are here to stay. Willie or Amy?
I'll dive in. As a historian, I would say this is a turn, a pedagogical turn that has already been taking place and that the COVID-19 crisis will accelerate it. It doesn't mean we'll keep, you know, in one single trajectory, but we've already seen, I think in the last century or so, a shift to a more integrated way of knowing, a more embodied ways of knowing, as well as sort of in some ways the over-rationalized Western academic culture is not very rational, right? It just doesn't make sense and it doesn't actually meet the reality of the complexity of human life and phenomena. So I think, you know, that kind of critique of the modern period has already occurred. I think we're moving that direction. I think this is going to fuel it. I think many of our institutions are lagging behind, however, certainly in our promotion and tenure practice, you know, in all of those places. But I think this is really fertile to continue to help that turn happen.
I agree with what both of you have said. I do think the digital footprint inside the academy is going to grow exponentially now because more people are seeing the possibilities. My worry is that the kind of changes that we ought to make pedagogically in terms of holding together the whole person, I hope that stays. It's going to be much more difficult to get that to stay, because my worry is that we're thinking about this still in a kind of managerial level and not understanding the kind of larger issues at play and what does it mean to teach and be whole people in the classroom. So I'm hoping that that will start to create something different, primarily because there are so many people gripped by fear at this moment. And I want to underscore this. I know a lot of people who are having real psychological struggle right now, real emotional struggle right now. And this is not simply, I'm saying it's not simply because we have to attend to this, but I think we have to understand the implications of that for the students, for the students and faculty, the learning environment that we create. As you know, as both of you know, in so many institutions, many faculty still don't want to imagine that they're doing anything other than teaching from the neck up, as one of my former colleagues would always say. And that way of thinking just has to go away. But the other aspect that I hope will be strengthened by this moment is the movement toward one another. I mean, the building of a deeper understanding of communion and of community that is necessary for our work as opposed to an add-on to our work. And my hope is that both those things can be sustained. But I do think in terms of the economics of it, the footprint's going to grow pretty strongly now.
So I suppose it is possible that we could go back to the illusion of youth loving, health loving society, a society that believes that all things that are young are desirable, even at the expense of the old. It is possible, I guess, for Madison Avenue, I'm going to use that phrase, to call us back to that illusion, and schools would follow suit, I guess, if the rest of the society followed suit. I can't imagine then what the repercussions would be to not live as if we understand what a pandemic is and could do and has done in our larger society, that we begin to teach people how to grieve, how to move into loss, how to move into death in a way that resilience is possible. If we don't do those things, if we go back to business as usual, how it used to be, that to me, that's the worst case scenario.
Yeah, I agree 100%. But again, I mean, here's what we have to see, that, and this is one of the great difficulties we're facing right now, without me, you know, putting too many of my own political cards on the table. I have great worries about the constant balancing of economic health with human health, and the difficulty of sustaining a focus on human beings at this moment, and the wider living reality in relationship to deep worries about the economy. That's not to say that the economy isn't important, but that balance itself is an imbalance.
The balance itself is part of the illusion. Amy, I cut you off. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. I think, and in that sense, our spiritual lives pull us deeply into the suffering in front of us and inside of us and around us, right? Our spiritual lives are not mechanisms to somehow get out of our lives over to some, you know, cloudy place somewhere, but to have, to be able to ask the questions we're asking here, the question you asked, Willie, about economy and human well-being, to be able to ask about human suffering. And I think especially for folks who live in a dominant culture, who've been privileged, often staying in our heads is a way to not address suffering. And I think to the degree we enter the classroom as more whole persons, we are more, we can take those risks and have more courage.
And that classrooms are not politically neutral places, to quote bell hooks. That what's happening in the larger society, what's happening in the larger context, impacts the classroom. And if teachers try to ignore that impact, then we do get this Western education that's kind of generic and one size fits all, therefore is not about the meaning of it for anyone, right? Meaning making for anyone, just credentialing.
Yeah, the mistake would be for us to carry on our teaching tasks, to finish the semesters or the quarters that are ahead of us. And students have gotten through the rest of the semester and the content, but not have processed what it means to be in the midst of a pandemic.
Regardless of the discipline they're studying.
Right, right. That would be the greatest tragedy.
Yep. So the Bible people can't say that's up to the theologians. The theologians can't say that's up to the pastoral care and the educators, right? That's a practical thing. I do theory, right? We don't have that luxury.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
Paul, is there another question?
There are many questions for you to consider.
We rolling, Paul. Go right ahead.
Absolutely. Here's a question that's been asked in a number of different ways by people involved in this webinar. Can you offer us some concrete pedagogical activities, assignments, that we can do with students to help them cultivate their imaginations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've thought a bit about this. I'm going to come back to a couple of things I've said. The first about thinking about the narration and our struggle against death and the fear of death. So one idea would be to have students talk about the ways in which their family, their communities have talked about death and the fear of death. To have them write about that, think about that. How successful or unsuccessful have they found those ways? That would be one. I have many more, but I want to just stop with that first one.
For me, it's in the framing of the question. The imagination and the sparking of imagination in our students is in the framing of the question. So the four questions that I have used in the past to spark students' imagination sound like this. Suppose, dot, dot, dot. Or what if, blah, blah, blah. Right? They're kind of open-ended, you imagine whatever you want to imagine questions. What would happen if? What would it mean if? So the way you pose the question says, do you want people to regurgitate information or do you want people to be imaginative? Do you want people to say back what you just said to them? Do you want students to say back to what they read? Do you want students to take information that they read from two or three sources and say that kind of amalgam? Or do you want them to think of something new, even fanciful, imaginative, that would take them to a new place? All of that happens in the way you frame questions.
I would say, by way of practice, that I wouldn't go straight to imagination. I think we need to begin with students actually connecting concretely to their own lives, because many of them are used to coming to class and leaving their lives at the door and then focusing on the expert who is the professor or on the material for the course, the content, right? So I want to first take a moment. I might do this like in a pair and share, even synchronously on Zoom, to identify what are two of the biggest changes in your life in the last 2 weeks. Your kids are home, you know, what, just to begin to concretely kind of bring themselves, be present to their own lives. Just do that briefly in 3 or 4 minutes, you know, in pairs. Then we might come back as a whole class and then move into, and I'm in a theological setting. And so I would ask, how is it with your soul? And we would go around and everybody would have 2 or 3 minutes, right? And that takes some time. So I feel like in order to then move to imagination, that kind of rooting and that kind of concreteness can help students. And then I've done, just some ideas here, I do writing prompts that are 1 minute free writes, where I'll give them the beginning of a sentence and they have a minute to just start writing, just kind of stream of consciousness. And those prompts, those sentence prompts, are going to be related to whatever kind of imagining we're doing. And that may even be discipline specific for you related to the pandemic. But for me, I'm thinking of the class I'm teaching now. One of those sentence prompts was, I wonder if right now God might be inviting me to, okay, you've got a minute, start writing.
Yeah, good stuff.
So those are some ideas.
Another way to think about it too is to look at the assignments that will finish out the semester, finish out the quarter. How can you rearrange those assignments, redesign those assignments, or just pivot them a little bit to make sure they make sense, the doing of those assignments makes sense during this moment. So they're not generic assignments that you've always done in the intro class no matter what. How do you tweak those assignments or change them completely so that you help students process what's going on in life right now?
Yeah. I love what you both said. And this ties into something Amy said earlier. And this ties also to something I mentioned earlier. I would want students, especially these days, to bring, and I know, Lynn, you mentioned that poetry is more than just the written or spoken word, but I would want, you know, students to bring a piece of poetry or a song or something that is speaking to them at this moment. And what I would want to do in the course of a class period is break it up. So in those moments when we're going to stop and hear some silence, into that silence I'd say, okay, someone share just a couple of lines of their poem. Others share a couple of lines of that hymn. Now, let's play a little bit of music for us, and let's just sit for it for a little while, and then go on. And then over the course of a class or the course of several classes, we will have shared quite a bit of what's speaking to people.
And another way to do that too, Willie, that I've done, well, it's not quite the same, but I use our online learning platform and invite students throughout the week to post images, mm-hmm. songs, poetry, mm-hmm. things that are speaking into their lives, kind of a what I call a resource village on our learning platform. And then they can share that with each other. And when we meet, you know, digitally, that is also now a pool of resources for cultivating imagination and kind of cross-pollinating, yeah.
That's good stuff.
Paul, one last question.
The last question. There's so many that I can choose from. I think thinking about, it looks like there's a number of them that deal with the question of, do the things that you're talking about apply to various educational contexts? So, seminary context, graduate school context, undergraduate student context, and one might even extend that out to other teaching and learning contexts. Wondering if you might speak to that a bit.
So I would say initially, yes, we're talking about teaching adults, right? So teaching religion, teaching theology, teaching all those disciplines that make up religion and theology is mostly about teaching adults. Sometimes we'll have people who are teaching high school students, but mostly about adults. So the short answer is yes. We're talking about moving into these issues with teaching adults in colleges, in universities, in seminaries, in Bible colleges, in the various places that adult education happens. I do think that context matters. And saying that though, context matters. So teaching and the expectations of context matter. So being savvy about and even aware of, there's a difference between having 100 people in an intro to religion lecture class online versus having 7 students in an intro to educational ministries class. And how you make these changes has to be up to you reading and knowing the context, but also intuiting your students that one of the things we didn't get to is that one of the tools of soulful pedagogy is your own intuition about yourself, the teaching, and the learner, right? So you bring those kind of spiritual practices into the classroom. So when you're trying out and risking these things, you're asking the students, how did that go? What was that like for you when we did that exercise, right? After the class or a couple of days later through email. But you're also responding to, intuiting, feeling the reactions of your students in that moment. So you know intuitively as well as cognitively what your context is like, intuitively and intuitively what your students are like. So you're using your spiritual arsenal to make these decisions in your context, knowing your all this is about adult education.
We always want to remember, and as Lynn said so brilliantly, the context is everything, but let's all remember that COVID-19 is in every context.
That's so, the pandemic thing, right? Pandemic.
It's in every context. So right. Obviously remembering that that's the case and remembering the difference of context, what we do want to risk recognizing that students are struggling at the site of learning right now. And so if we think not from the perspective of the teacher teaching in different contexts, but the students learning in different contexts at the site of a pandemic, then I can see we can hold the difference of the context, but also where we have to, in some ways, draw from each other, no matter what our context is, draw from each other. I obviously, I teach in a theological context, and those who teach in religious studies is different. But let's keep in mind what we're struggling with right now. We're struggling with the death and the fear of death at one level, and many other things we've already talked about.
Yeah, I teach in both. And so I'm also teaching in an undergrad religion classroom. And that is a different context with a different set of expectations and a different student population. And I take that very seriously. However, I don't think that means I can't talk about either invite, let me put it this way, I still invite conversations about students' spiritual lives, because I think that's only responsible in an educational environment. And what I've done now is posted on our learning platform a breathing exercise that I do in class every time we meet. So they can access that anytime. And then shifted some of the discussion board questions a little bit for those undergraduate students to be able to do a little bit more checking in and thinking critically about what they're experiencing in the pandemic, and their own emotional world, Willie, as it also connects to the material we've covered in the course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Willie Jennings. Thank you, Dr. Amy Oden, for this rich, rich conversation. We also thank our participants that have gone along on this conversation with us. This has actually been quite fun. Please know that we're uploading a recording of this conversation onto our own Wabash Center website, as well as it'll be uploaded on our YouTube channel. And we will continue to do webinars. Our next webinar our guest will be Dr. Ralph Watkins at Columbia Theological Seminary, as well as Sophronia Scott, who is a published novelist. That topic will be on the use of image and storytelling in online teaching. So it continues the conversation that we've actually started here, that this notion of holistic teaching, this notion of soul pedagogy, this notion of bringing your whole self to the classroom, in times where we need to risk, is the conversation that we at the Wabash Center will be pursuing in depth. Once again, my friends, I thank you.
Thank you. It's been lovely to be here.
It has been great to be here.
And we're out.